There is a handout for this presentation, which I prepared for. The first outing of this paper was last May, when I presented in a Thomas panel with Ulva and with Thomas's biographer Mimi Dates at the Baltic Music Conference in Canterbury. You'll probably see from the handout that it assumes nothing of the audience in terms of knowledge of Balto-Finnic culture. So I hope this isn't too sort of patronising for an audience that are Balto-Finnic in the main part. But obviously for the UK audience, there was a lot of very unfamiliar material there. So this follows on very nicely from Anu's talk about, which included talking about Lipo Sumura, who I will come to mention. Before looking at four composers influenced by Thomas's music, I'd like briefly to summarise the characteristic traits of his style. First of all, probably the most prominent achievement of Thomas's music is his use of the choral palette, which he uses in an almost orchestral way, covering a very wide emotional and dramatic span through subtly changing voicings and colourings. Secondly, of course, the integral use of regulao or runic song, ancient Estonian traditional music, as compositional material. Earlier composers had used these ancient melodies, but it is the manner in which Thomas uses regulao which is the hallmark of his style. He preserves the themes intact without traditional development, weaving ever-changing choral textures around them. Regulao features in much, but not all, of Thomas's work. Third characteristic is the extensive use of repetition, with variety achieved by his choral scoring and through changes in meaning and alliteration within the texts. This aspect has often led Thomas to be labelled erroneously as a minimalist. Fourthly, the syncretic, that is, the all-embracing nature of Thomas's mature works. This term Thomas first applied to Estonian calendar songs in 1969, a work which he felt defined his mature style. Syncretism is a phenomenon witnessed particularly in the folk cultures of the Arctic latitudes, such as the Sami of Lapland. Thomas feels a particular affinity with these cultures. Syncretism perhaps provides the antithesis to the Estonian Lutheranism in which he was raised. Next characteristic is shamanism. The shaman or shaman drum is used in a number of important works, such as the seminal Rawa Nedmina, Curse Upon Iron, which we heard in its heavy metal version yesterday. Thomas has been deeply affected during his studies in Moscow by a performance by Siberian shaman drummers. Although there appears to be as yet no historical evidence linking the drum to his own country, Thomas is yet convinced that the shaman drum is part of Estonia's ancient past. And the final characteristic is the inextricable link between Thomas's music and Estonian Baltic identity. Many of the above traits have of course been evident in the music of other 20th century composers, but it's the bringing together of these traits which gives rise to Thomas's unmistakable voice. Can Thomas's voice then be said to be a unique phenomenon? There has existed no such thing as a Thomas school. The composer has, on the whole, worked as a lone voice, with a characteristic reticence to speak about or promote his own work. Existing as a freelance composer from 1969, supported by the Soviet state, he failed to secure an academic post which might have cultivated a line of student composers in his wake. Indeed, in his characteristically self-effacing manner, Thomas initially said he had few disciples, thank goodness. However, closer examination reveals that aspects of his principles and style have been assimilated by a number of younger composers who have yet managed to make the material their own. This is true of two important Estonian composers, both of whom had significantly been high school pupils of Thomas when he was teaching in the 1960s. The first is Lepo Sumura, mentioned by Anu in the last presentation. Summer is a well-known Estonian symphonist, widely performed now in Estonian concert programmes. He was highly prolific in the 1990s, a time when the newfound freedom after the fall of communism caused a creative surge in Estonia. Summer's style is eclectic, influenced by the founders of the Estonian style earlier in the 20th century. These include his teacher, Heino Ella, as well as Kyrillos Kreik and Mart Saar. Yet he was also a pioneer in electroacoustic and computer music. Tormis recounted that in one work, Saara Pigam Laul Merest, Island Maiden Song from the Sea, for double mixed choir, Suomura had specifically acknowledged a debt to him. Perhaps it was the ritual setting of this piece, drawn from Estonia's folk epic, the Kalevipoeg, that impelled Suomura to turn to quasi-regular melodies. These have characteristic eight-syllable word rhythms and a small vocal compass. Unlike Tormis, these are, however, of Suomura's own making. In the Tormis manner, the Reigi-like themes are varied by transposition, without thematic development, but then contrasted with more chromatic material. At the opening, one choir whispers while the other sings, which heightens the sense of ritual. And this is a few bars into the opening. Textures using the small compass folk-like melody in various transpositions against bare fifths. Recall Thomas's treatment of Regulal in, for example, Why John is Awaited, from the last set of Eesti Kalendri Laulud, the Estonian calendar songs. Like Suomura, was a composition pupil of Tormis in his formative years of high school in Tallinn. Less prolific than Suomura, Lepik was influenced by the avant-garde movement of the 70s. Yet he keenly acknowledged Tormis's influence on his choral music, once telling Tormis that he had taken his ideas and developed them. This is evident in the choral work Three Poems by Eti Alver for Male Chorus, 1974. Looking through the score of this cycle together, Tormis drew my attention to the third song, Raigi Taza Minugar, where a wordless choral accompaniment is built up with staggered entries upwards through the voices, beginning with a bottom C in the basses. Above this, a solo baritone line sings the small compassed melody. Thank you. gesture vividly recalls the layering of wordless voices in the haunting opening of Thomas's Call to the Midsummer Bonfire, number one, from the last set of Estonian calendar songs. Although it must be said that Thomas is more sympathetic to his tenors and basses. Here, the close imitation of two solo voices in distanza additionally creates a dramatic sense of space. There is, of course, a great cultural affinity between Estonia and Finland, its neighbour 80 kilometres north across the Baltic. The countries share a common folklore and an ancient song tradition, Runolaul in Finnish, as well as a closeness in their Finno-Ugric languages. Thomas had, from early in his composing career, built a close relationship with and written for many Finnish choirs and their conductors. Pekka Jalkanen, born 1946, is a Finnish composer whose first compositions drew on folk music and jazz. While acknowledging a fascination with Ligeti and Lutoslavski in the 70s, Jalkanen also recognises an influence from the American minimalist movement in the following decade, Reich, Riley, and later in Estonia, Peart. Thomas described how he met Jalkanen in Helsinki in the late 70s during a performance over several days of his entire epic choral cycle, Forgotten Peoples. Jalkanen greatly admired this work, and Thomas recounted how the composer spent an entire day talking in depth about Estonian and Finnish culture and the Kalevala. Speaking about the influence of Thomas on his music, Jalkanen specifically drew attention to one work, this time an instrumental piece. Violon Orja, The Surf of Estonia, is written for string orchestra and won first prize at the prominent international folk festival in Kaustinen, North Finland, in 1980. Based on the Kalevala, this Orphic tale recounts the creation of the Kantila, or ancient Finnish zither. Jalkanen uses a Finnish Pelimani melody, a dance melody, to depict the secular world, distinguishing this from the sacral hypnotic world of Kalevala music, to which he gives the rarefied timbre of string harmonics. Although the procedure of phased entries is perhaps more reminiscent of American minimalist work, such as Reich's Vermont Counterpoint, in Violon Orja, Jalkanen specifically attributes to Thomas his use of short, repetitive motifs derived from Runolaul. He also acknowledges Thomas's influence on the way in which he seeks to create a contrasting meditative atmosphere in the manner of archaic Kalevala song. In 1976, Thomas visited Jyväskylä, a university city in central Finland, to hear a performance of Karelian Destiny, another part of the Forgotten People cycle. The work was conducted by Pekka Kostiainen, now one of the most established and respected Finnish choral composers. Kostiainen writes that he was completely infatuated with Tormas's music after that first encounter, and has gone on to incorporate ancient Finnish runolaulu, or rather its essence, into many of his works. Pakkasen Luku, The Frost's Incantation, is another Kalevala-based work, a set of short songs for mixed choir in varying combinations. As with the Sumera, the musical material is entirely Kostiainen's own, but based on runolaulu principles. Melodies are of a very limited compass, mostly spanning only a minor third, which the composer points out is typical of the oldest Finnish runolaulu style. Some songs follow the traditional performance pattern of a leader's part echoed by a chorus, the last notes of each line being doubled by the singers of the next line, thus forming a continuous chain of sound. Kostiainen echoes Tormas in his approach, but is less purist. He will combine themes and mix authentic and composed melodies within the same works. The third song of this cycle, Kilon Sula Kilamista, follows Tormas's principles of a repeated, unchanged original melody, varied only by the choral scoring. A sense of onward movement is created by a cumulative thickening of the choral texture. The bare, angular theme of Kilon Sula, with its prominent diminished fifth, reinforces the glacial theme of the Kalevala poetry. Technique of choral orchestration has already been identified as the first characteristic of Tormas's music, a notable example being the final song, Jaani Laulut, from Estonian calendar songs. Here the original regulaarm theme moves between voices, subtly building in intensity with a sense of inevitable onward movement. The harmonisation builds from a unison line against a pedal note, through simple imitation to harmonisation in parallel triads, then sevenths, ninths, and finally 11th chords. The practice of cumulative scoring was surely coloured, even if subconsciously, by Tormas's formative experiences as a child. In Mimi Dates' biography, he recalls sitting beside his father at the organ of the village church, experiencing the thrill of the increasing power of the organ's registration, as he was allowed to pull out the stops.
Thank you.
In conclusion, Pekka Kostiainen, in a recent communication, provided a neat summary of Thomas's legacy. I feel the most significant achievement of Thomas's music is how he emphasises the most relevant characteristics of real folk music. The product is clearly archaic, yet clearly music of our time.
I think there are comments. I hope there are comments. Otherwise, I have some.
As long as it's not about my Finnish pronunciation.
No. I'm really surprised that you can hear Thomas' influence. You can really hear his style also in the compositions of his pupils or followers. I mean, it's a very individual style, you're absolutely right. But I just want to, only one thought or two thoughts which I have. Together with that. I mean, you have some kind of this archaic or shaman choral music in Finland, and you have it even in Lapland. I think about Jan Sandström in northern Sweden, who also uses Sami language and creates some kind of yoiks which are incorporated. And additionally, of course, there is some folk music or some music which is considered to be vernacular, incorporated in this music. Would you maybe go so far to say that Thomas created something like an Estonian tone, Estonian sound, or would that be absolutely ahead?
Estonian top? Sound?
Yeah.
It's probably, I don't quite feel qualified to say that, to answer that. I mean, to me, I hear it as an outsider, I suppose, because I've come into the culture from outside, so... I can hear it's very distinctly belonging to the tradition of the Estonian tradition. Of course, it's a very individual voice, but I don't. It's interesting that most of those works, the two Sumra and Lepik, I'm identified works that were influenced by Thomas, but they were obviously very, very wide in there. Their style wouldn't be that type of style for a lot of their pieces. So that was an illustration, really. Mm-hmm. I think in a sense, Thomas is did probably very difficult to imitate without almost going into pastiche because it's such a distinct style. I know there are some American composers who I haven't yet pinned down, but Mimi Dates. I was discussing it, who have used sort of regular type themes in the same sort of way. I've explored Thomas's techniques, if you like. Mm. It'd be slightly artificial to do that from outside the culture.
Please.
Seen from here, it seems that Thomas' reception in an English-speaking area is much more active in America than in Great Britain. And we have discussed with Ray Turner, our attaché, in London, that maybe British choral tradition is too different to swallow this pre-Christian music. But what is your opinion, because you are the British, choral
conductor? Well, Britain has a very strong choral tradition, so it's surprising, and particularly amateur choirs, we have very strong choral tradition. But it's quite surprising that Thomas tends to be the preserve slightly of the choral, slightly specialist choral communities, perhaps, and conductors who are particularly interested in slightly esoteric choral music. It hasn't become yet, I don't think, mainstream for most British choirs. I do know, for example, a choir in Bristol, a chamber choir, has done a number of Thomas works. They're quite experienced singers. I think there's various problems. I mean, I think, first of all, the language is obviously a big obstacle, even though Estonian isn't actually. I mean, speaking as a complete non-Estonian speaker, I think it's not probably as difficult as it seems to learn to sing, in that it's totally phonetic and it's very singable as well. I think there's also the problem of the theme, because Thomas's music doesn't read so much. choral music is automatically has a church setting, and I remember going to a concert with Thomas where Arvo Pärt was, I think the Beatitudes were performed, followed by Curse Upon Ireland. Thomas was very amused by the idea that Pärt's music was up there, and he said, "My music is down there." So I mean that worked in a concert hall; it wouldn't really have worked in a church. And I think that probably slightly acts against. I think another one of the problems is that a lot of Thomas's works are made up of very large collections of very short pieces. For example, Estonian Calendar Songs, I think, is 59 songs or something like that. And I think, you know, from an audience's point of view, and certainly from a choir's point of view, that's too much to actually to sing in one performance. I don't think they were ever intended as a whole set to be sung as one. But big collections of small pieces, there are only a couple of Thomas pieces over 10 minutes, I think, apart from Estonian Ballads, which is the one great, complete exception. Curse Upon Iron is the obvious, and that has been the most widely performed, certainly in America. There are a lot of American performances on YouTube.
But what do you think about singing Thomas in translation? Because he is very much insisting doing translations, single translations. And, for example, Mimi Dietz is absolutely against that he should spend his valuable time on doing such a stupid thing.
Well, I suppose there are two schools. There's a sort of English National Opera school which says that the meaning of the words should be conveyed, and that's almost the absolute priority. And then the sound of the words almost comes second. And then there are the purists who would say that the sound of the words is almost can't be touched. It has to be stayed. I mean, I think if it made the music more accessible, I think there's a case for translation. But I have to, leading on from that, talk about just mention briefly the translations in the Fenike German scores made by I'm not quite sure who it was, an Estonian.
Very many people.
Yeah. Actually, very poor translations. Well, poor translations, but also not very easily singable translations. I think they could actually have an adverse effect on a conductor who picked up a score and looked through it to interpret the meaning. Just very awkward words placed on very difficult vowels, and I mean, they just don't work. I think they need a complete rethink, and I think the publishers need to be convinced that that's a way forward. And I think Thomas does as well. Actually, he's very defensive about the translations, and it's quite difficult to convince him that it would be in the interest of the music to rethink them.
Just if I may add, from my experience, I sang quite a lot of Thomas in my male choir in Stockholm, and it's quite feasible to sing it in Estonian. We have no Estonian native speaker, but it's no problem. Another British voice, please.
Is it true, in fact, that he constricts himself to this medium, to choral music, by and large? Because, I mean, if that is the case, I mean, it's one reason why, I mean, Pärt, you know, is much more wide-ranging,
yes.
And that disseminates, and as he gets bigger, other things get pushed to the side, really, you know, it's a natural mechanism of canonization, really. The significant obscures what may be only marginally less significant, if at all, you know, that's what happens.
Yeah.
But I mean, I can't see that anyone who confines himself to just that kind of medium is likely to move centre stage.
Yes,
much,
I think that's
international.
Well, it's interesting, in his early career, he, after the Moscow and Tallinn Conservatoire, he did write a number of very big orchestral works. There was an overture, Avamang, the overtures of choir, and they're performed, I think, in Estonia quite regularly.
Orchestras.
Yeah.
That's Uwe Boyle, because they may have the pubs and reports everyone.
He also wrote an opera early on.
Oh, I see. I didn't realise he had.
Yes. This is all going back to quite the 60s. Gradually, in the course of the 60s, as the regular bass music became, he began to see that probably as his identity in many ways. ways. It almost exclusively took over. It's quite interesting that he wrote his longest piece is Estonian Ballads, which was written in 1980 for the Olympics, which uses a set of very epic Estonian ballads. But they're set for choir with soloists and full orchestra. But it's very interesting that the use of the orchestra is very, very minimal, actually. Not minimalist, but minimal. I mean, he uses the orchestra almost just as punctuation for the singers. There are no orchestral interludes, there are no overtures, there are little, very short fanfares, and then it's choir, 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 or soloists. And I think that's very significant about his role of the orchestra. I've asked him that. I asked him why he didn't... being given that opportunity, the orchestra in front of him, why not exploit it? And he said he didn't feel it was necessary.
Has he been explicit about why he stopped composing?
Well, he had a heart attack in the late 1990s. Yeah. And I think took quite a lot of time out to recuperate. And he wrote, I think, on the last score, Koik, which means that's all. He considered that his work was finished. It's very strange, but he has since rearranged various choral pieces, and very interesting, for his 80th birthday, which was 2 years ago, he scored some choral pieces for string orchestra, which was very interesting, because Mimi Dates, his presentation at Canterbury, went into some detail. It's not an exact transcription. There were very subtle changes made in rhythm and things, which made it more than just an arrangement of a choral piece. It became a new composition. But in some ways, it was almost hiding behind the mask of the choral piece that it started out as, I think.
Okay, we have one last question.
It's not really a question. Since you brought up this Finnish music, so maybe it's not out of place for me to recall the reactions in Finland to these works to this style of Pekka Jalka and Pekka Kostia. It's too bad that Pesa doesn't seem to be here, because he knows Pekka Jalkanen very well, but it was really very, very intriguing, because this style in Finland, it was sort of, it's very counter-cultural, because we had this very, very monolithic movement of avant-garde progressive music in Finland. So these are really the first persons, I think, who intervened in that. And I didn't know that they were so directly influenced by Tomis, but they told you.
Well, I'm hoping to actually see Jalkanen on my way back to the UK, so I will be able to hopefully explore it a little bit more. I mean, both of them were sort of... The impression was that the experience of it was more than just the experience of the music, it was entering into that world which had profoundly influenced them afterwards in their own work.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.